So we're in the story of the sale of Joseph, and we're on page 233. And we're in sentence 18. Joseph now is nearing the brothers. Vayiru oto merachok, and they saw him from a distance. Uveterem yikrav alehem, and before he drew close to them, vayitnaklu oto, and they conspired against him. Lahamito, with the intent of killing him. They see him from a distance. Uveterem yikrav alehem, vayitnaklu oto, lahamito. And when one reads this, one can't help but hear words that echo of the binding of Isaac in chapter 22, which is the binding story. We're told that as Abraham and Isaac come close to Moriah, Bayom HaShlishi, sentence 4, page 109, and Abraham lifted up his eyes, Vayar et hamakom merachok, and he saw the place from a distance. And of course, the Akedah seems to have nothing at all to do with the story of Joseph, but let us remember that in its schematic sense, the story of the Akedah is Abraham about ready to lose his son Isaac at the last moment he's saved. And in a certain sense, that's what's happening here. It's Joseph who is about ready to be lost to his father. So while the settings are different, it's not unusual in the biblical text, in the Torah, for language to be similar. God says to Abraham, go take your son to Moriah, and Abraham says, Hineni, here I am. That's not a common word. It's a pretty well-known word. And when Jacob says to Joseph, go seek out the welfare of your brothers, he also says, here I am. And in fact, we argued that when Joseph was in the pit and he looks up, and he probably sees the brothers hovering around the rim of the pit, who he really sees is his father, because he knows that his father has sent him there, and who knows, maybe he's thinking that the whole thing was a setup. But separate from that, it's the imagery of, in the Akedah, father with the knife over Isaac, and here, the brothers, and he sees through the brothers his father, who are, if you will, leaning over him as Joseph is in the pit. So there are echoes, and vayitnaklu oto lamito, there are some commentators who turn this around, and they do it in a complicated grammatical way. The Sephardim does this, and understands this phrase that in its simplest sense mean that they conspired against him to slay him, they turn it around. And they say that they acted because they thought that Joseph was conspiring against them.
To kill them, he was what against them?
Well, but one would wonder, why is it, I mean, the brothers were no small people, why is it that they sold Joseph? And it is here that the great Sephardo, who lived in Italy in the 15th, 16th century, he writes that the brothers saw Yosef, he uses the word, as a rodef, as a pursuer. That he was out to usurp them. He was out to take their blessings. And so they felt that they had a right to defend themselves. And so that's the way the Sephardo understands vayitnaklu oto lamito. Not that they conspired against him, but they said, we have to take action because Joseph is conspiring against us. Here it is. I see it here. On 18, on the left-hand side, you'll see both opinions. See, we don't have to come to class. It's right here. Both opinions are here. Ted, you want to take it? 18, they planned.
It's a little hard for me to
okay,
read.
Okay, anyone?
Yeru Oto, is that what you meant?
Yeah, before he came near him, they conspired.
They planned.
Go ahead.
Does
Florence, go ahead. They planned?
They planned to slay him before he came near, as the Midrash asserts, by inciting dogs to attack
That's
him.
That's a position. You know, to conspire sounds like it's mental. There's also an opinion they sent dogs so that they should not have to shed his blood themselves. That's Nachmanides, the end. Now look at this next argument.
They argued among themselves that they had a legitimate cause for killing him. They reasoned, he has not come in our interest, but only to find fault which he can report to our father, or even for which we may be punished by God. Then he alone would remain blessed, and they suffered death in this world or punishment in the next. Thus their subsequent action was regarded by them as self-defense.
S is the sophronal. The way he understands it is vayitnaklu oto, and they, the brothers, conspired against him, against Joseph, lahamitam. They understand the last word of the Hebraic text as a separate word, and he offers many examples where the singular possessive is turned into the plural, and he understands it to mean the following. They conspired against Joseph, stop, lahamitam, because they saw Joseph as being ready to kill them. Because Joseph was interested in getting the blessings for himself. As we pointed out, he dreams of stars, which is the metaphor for children, and he dreams of sheaves, which is about land. And land and children, those are always the elements of the covenant. And they're in a family where they know historically the younger one is always getting the covenantal blessings. So they say, we're in trouble. Joseph intends to take the blessings. He's the eldest from Rachel, Jacob's favorite. And therefore, when they see Joseph coming towards him, they say, wait a minute, we know what this is about. He's coming towards us in order to do us harm. Therefore, we have no choice but to defend themselves. The tragedy is this is what they thought. Who knows what Joseph was really thinking? I was in the atria last night. I try to go every Monday night, and we talk about the portion. And all I do is I throw out, oh, this is the portion of Vayishlach that talks about enemies. Has anybody ever had an enemy? And I'm talking to people who are 80, 90, 100 years old. And people started opening up. And there was one woman who raised her hand and said, well, what does it mean that, Rabbi, that somebody's my enemy? Maybe I think that person is my enemy, but if I ever spoke to this person, I'd find out that what I may think this person thinks about me is not what this person thinks. This person should not be my enemy. And this is, I always listen very, very closely. I don't know how far you are, but to wisdom that comes with experience, with age.
Love you. But there's a question here of logic, isn't there? One against all the brothers? Did they really think that one brother could overcome all of them?
Right. And look, that's a fair question. But when a person becomes paranoid, yeah, you think one person can overcome you. There's also some theories that Joseph was the protector of the children of the handmaids. That's the way they read the beginning of chapter 37. So, I mean, within the brothers, in the sale itself, there could have been, the ranks could have been split. Were they all one voice in wanting to sell Joseph? It's not so, let's not so simple. Let's see what happens. Sentence 19. Vayomru ish el achiv. So one says to the other, Hine Baal Hachalomo Talazeba. Behold, the master of dreams, this one is coming. Everyone dreams. Who doesn't dream? Probably every person. It's very rare, I think, to find a person who's gone through life not having dreamt. But there are very few masters of dreams. The Bible refers to very few people as a master of dreams. And Joseph is referred to as a Baal HaChalamot, as a master of dreams. That means, this person is not just a dreamer. He's not just having a chalom. He's a master of dreams. That's what they fear, that he could take this dream and he can turn this into reality. Behold, the master of dreams is coming. Vata. And now, Lichu v'nahargehu, Nebuch. Come, let us kill him. V'nashlicheyu b'achar haborot, and we will cast him into one of the pits. V'amarnu, and we will say chayara a'achalatu. We will say that an evil beast consumed him. V'nire ma'yihiyu chalomotav. Not clear who says this phrase. V'nire ma'yihiyu chalomotav. The simple text is that they say, and we will see what will become of his dreams, because he will be gone. There's even an opinion in the Midrash that v'nireh mayu chalamotav are not the words of the brothers, but it's God chiming in, where God says, okay, we'll see whose dream is going to come true, whether your efforts to stop Joseph, or will Joseph's dream itself come true. And what happens? Vayishma Reuven, and Reuven is listening. Vayatzilehu miyadam, and he saves Joseph from their hands. Vayome, and he says, Lo nakenu nafesh, let us not smite him, let us not kill him. Vayome aleihem Reuven, and Reuven says to them, Al tishpachu dam, don't spill his blood. Hashlichu oto al habor hazeh, cast him into this pit, asher bamidbar, which is in the desert, v'yad al tishlichu bo, and let us not cast a hand against him. And now the Bible explains, why does Reuven do this? Leman hatzilo tomi adam, in order to save him, that is Joseph, from their hands, from the hands of the brothers, lahashivo el aviv, to return him to his father. So there's a stutter step here. In sentence 20, they say, let us kill him and then throw him into the pit. Let us kill him and throw him into the pit. What does Reuven say?
Let's not kill him.
But what should we do?
Let's throw him into the pit.
Now, when the brothers hear that, throw him into the pit, and what will happen to Joseph in the pit?
He will die.
But what Reuven is arguing with the brothers, that there's going to be a difference. At least we don't have to directly take his life. It's still homicide.
Still subtle.
It's right, but at least we're not. He's saying to them,
the blood.
Don't spill his blood. Throw him into the pit. But our hands should not. Obviously, they've thrown him into the pit. But our hands should not be cast against him. Now, that's what he says to the brothers to try to calm them. And then the text explains what were the intentions of Reuven. The intention of Reuven was his goal was to save him. So I want to open up with this question. Oh, the Bible is recording its intentions. Okay, you know, either we accept it or we reject it. But the Bible says, Lema'an, in order. It is telling us what was in Reuven's mind. Now, here's the question that I have. It seems that Reuven is coming to Joseph's defense on some level. It says that his intent was to save him. He tries to calm the brothers, because the brothers first intend to kill him directly, literally, to shoot him, to strangle him. And then Reuven says to them, calm down, let's throw him in the pit, he'll die from thirst, he'll die from hunger, but at least then we don't have to directly kill him. But his intent was to save him. My question is, why is it Reuven who is taking this position?
How old is Reuven in relation to Joseph?
That's a good question. We know that Joseph was 17. So Reuven probably, they were born a year apart, he's in his 30s.
So he was mid-30s.
Reuven was the eldest.
He was the eldest.
Yes, Ruby.
Well, as the eldest, maybe, and seeing himself as leader of the covenant, this would be a pretty bad way to start his future ruling by having that blood on his hands.
Great. So, Reuven, as Ruby is saying, Reuven is the eldest son of Leah. You know, the book of Genesis is a great work to analyze the characters and the psychology and the intrigues and the nuances, but in the end, the book of Genesis is a covenantal work. It's a covenant. Basically, the book of Genesis offers a blueprint of a beautiful world in Eden, a very universal world. It doesn't work. And then God says, I choose Abraham and Sarah. And the mission of Abraham and Sarah is to bring the world back to Eden, to an Eden that is not angelic, but an Eden that is real. That's basically what it is. Now the question is, who is going to be given that covenantal responsibility? That doesn't mean, by the way, that Judaism believes that those outside of the covenant of Judaism have nothing to contribute. Of course, we have so much to gain from identity, we have so much to gain from different disciplines, and you know, Judaism may have given birth to Christianity and Islam, but we have much to gain from other faith communities. But Judaism has something very distinct to contribute. That's the covenant. Now the question is, who is going to be charged with that responsibility of covenantal continuity? And that's basically what this book is about. Abraham is told, you're tapped, you're going to be the father of the covenant. And Abraham runs into trouble because there are those who oppose him. I think Lot opposes him, Avimelech opposes him, Melchizedek opposes him, a whole bunch of characters. Then the question is, okay, so it's Abraham and Sarah's. Who's going to be the next one? Is it going to be Isaac or Ishmael? Is it going to be Esau or Jacob? Now it's Jacob's. Who's going to be the next one? Who will be the next one? And basically the story of Joseph, the way it concludes is it's going to be all of the children of Jacob. And that's the way the book ends. The process of saying that it's going to be one child to the exclusion of another ends in the last 15 chapters. In the last 14, 15 chapters, everyone is going to be part of the family of Jacob. But at this point, they don't know that. That's what this story is about. So at this point, who is going to inherit Jacob? Well, Jacob's got two primary wives. You know, without rationalizing, he's got two primary wives, Leah and Rachel. Who is the eldest of Leah? Reuven. So he's primed to be that candidate. Ah, but who is the eldest of Rachel? And Rachel is his favorite. It's none other than Joseph. So who are the key competitors? It is Joseph and Reuven. So if something happens to Reuven, whose ultimate responsibility is it in the biblical narrative? If something happens to Joseph and Reuven is there and he's the eldest, first of all, he's the eldest child of Jacob. He's the eldest of Leah. And this battle between who is going to inherit Jacob is also a battle in its own way between Rachel and Leah in its own way. Correct? Because if it's Joseph, it's Rachel. If it's going to be Reuven, then it's going to be Leah. So Reuven says, wait a minute. This is my responsibility. I can't let this happen. I've got to step in. And he, therefore, comes to the defense of Joseph, recognizing that if Joseph is going to be sold, he is the person who is going to be blamed. He is the one who is going to be at fault. He is pushed, therefore, to come forward and to defend Joseph. I'll take just a tissue. Any thoughts on this? Any reflections on this?
The custom of the eldest inheriting the role, the next, doesn't always make sense. If you even look, you know, in more modern times, very often the eldest is not the most capable.
It happens in the royal family.
It happens in business. You know, the grandfather builds up a big business. He struggles. His son is next. And the grandson is not necessarily the one who should take over.
And the Bible absolutely would agree with you, Flora, because when we look at the biblical narrative in the end, I'd mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when the Pope calls us, you are our older brother. It gets me nervous because older brothers in the Bible don't do that well. It's always the younger brother. Isaac was younger than Ishmael and Jacob was younger than Esau. And in the end, Reuven is not going to be the primary son, the primary leader. I mean, all of them will be involved, but the primary one is going to be, from Leah's side, it's going to be ultimately, who will it be? Who will it be? Judah. It's not Reuven, and it's not going to be Shimon, and it's not going to be Levi. Still, when the game begins, the playing field's not even. The eldest has, what's the expression, a foot up? He has a leg up. Thank you, Howard. The eldest has an advantage, but you're absolutely right. There's a difference between Bechora. Bechora means the eldest. Reuven was the eldest. And a play on the word Bechora is Beracha.
Beracha.
It's with a chet.
But it's
very, very nice. Very nice. There's a difference, Brindle's saying, between Bechora, the eldest, and Bechira with a chet means the one who ultimately is chosen. Or I was saying the difference between the Bechor and the Beracha. The blessing goes to the one who is worthy. You have to be worthy of it. And Reuven still wants to be in the game, and therefore he's coming to Joseph's defense. It's not going to work out to his benefit. Yes, Ted?
Well, it just seems, I'm just a little bit taken off here from what Flora said, that in the end, in each of these competitive situations, it's always the best man wins, not the oldest, not necessarily the youngest. But the person who has undergone the most difficult challenges and proves himself to be the wisest or the best endowed that wins.
I'm sorry, Ruby?
I'm saying we don't know that. We don't know what it would have been like had one of the other brothers, you know, gotten leadership. So we don't really know that it was the best based on what happened. We just assume it was the best.
Well, right. If Joseph is taken, I'm sorry, if Reuben is taken upon himself to look out for Joseph in view of the fact that he's the eldest, how does he justify the selling of Joseph?
Well, what happens here, it's actually quite remarkable. In just a few more sentences, so we'll see it in its full context. In sentence 23, I'm going to read this and I want to take your comment, Howard. Or do you want to, just a couple more sentences and I'll come back to you, Howard, okay? It says, Vayikasher vayosef elechav, this relates to what you're saying, Estelle. And when Joseph came to his brethren, vayavshitu et Yosef et kutanto, they take off his coat of many colors. First of all, this guy's walking with his coat. He's walking with his fleece. I mean, give me a break.
He's very proud of it.
See this guy coming with the coat of many colors.
That's what killed
oh,
him.
My God. That's and this is the coat of royalty.
That's what
Remember,
killed
coats
them.
In the Bible, what did we say? That coats in the Bible are always the sign of political kingship, of political leadership. Another word for coat, Brindel is saying, is beged. And actually, I like that word, beged, because beged, you could vocalize it not as beged, but bogade. Bogade means one who conspires, one who rebels. Once you get, you know, if you read the story of King David, King David is a very pure soul until he gets into politics. As soon as he gets into politics, excuse me, he starts lying. Right away, you've got to please everyone, you've got to say two things at the same time. And it's interesting that in the Bible, the word or the symbol of the leadership is the beged.
Mantle.
Is the coat, is the mantle. And beged really tells us the challenge of the leadership. Once you're in that position, it is very, very, very difficult to be absolutely true to principles. Anyway, so Ikasher by Yosef Elechav, now the brothers see Joseph and they want to conspire against Joseph. They want to get rid of Joseph. But they can't get rid of Joseph from the biblical perspective until they do what? They got to take off his coat. You can't. That's the language of the Bible, so you can't do anything to Joseph until you take off his coat. Vayashitu et Yosef et kutanto.
Et
ketone tapasim ashe'alav. They take it off. Once it's off, then he's vulnerable. As long as it's on, it's like the Superman's cape or something. As long as it's on, there's nothing they can do with him. Vayikachuhu. And they took him. Vayashlichu oto habora. And they throw him into the pit. They cast him into the pit. And then there's this vivid description. Vahabor reik. And the pit was empty. Ein bo mayim.
No water.
There was no water in the pit. Vayeshvu lechol lechem. Could you imagine? He's in the pit. There's no indication what Joseph was doing in the pit. What was he doing? I get nervous when I get stuck in an elevator. He's in a pit. What was he doing? Was he crying? What? There's no expression here. But one can only imagine what he was doing.
Looking to get out.
Vayeshvu lecho lechem. And as he's in the pit, probably begging in agony and praying and crying and wailing, what are they doing? They're sitting and they're eating bread. And bread is a euphemism. They're having a big meal. They get McDavid's meal, Vayeshvu lecho lechem, and I'm going to take Howard's comment. Howard looks like he's plotting here. So
I'm bursting. I can say it and not say it. But you know,
it disturbs me.
Ted says we should take a vote whether we should.
You vote. Yeah, I'll do whatever you say. I'm not plotting. Something disturbs me.
I like people who are plotting.
Well, you know, I've done my share of that. Something disturbs me. I have to bring it up, and it's a minor point, but you know, to hear you say about what the Pope said bothers me.
Oh, we're back to the Pope.
It bothers me. I'll tell you why it bothers me. Because I remember when he said it, he was the first Pope to visit the synagogue in Rome and visit the head rabbi of Rome, and he said, "You are our brothers, you are our elder brothers." If he said that, I was very touched by it, because I wasn't as intelligent as I am now about the younger serving the elder. You know? It's only if you know that that it's poisonous, you know. If you're that, you know, if you're smart, you're in trouble, you know. Right. But I think within the context of where he was, I think that you should give him the benefit of the doubt to say that he meant it not in the context of the younger brother, the elder brother serving the younger brother, but he meant it in the context of being in the synagogue of Rome, being the first rabbi to visit, the first pope to visit, and he's a rabbi too because he's a teacher, but to be the first pope to visit the synagogue of Rome, to visit the head rabbi of Rome, and to say it in that context, and to give him the kuvvet of being, of meaning it in a way that was respectful and not, didn't have the meaning that we're ascribing to it.
Right, I actually, you know, 20 years ago I could not have started to understand what you were talking about. Now, 20 years later, some people would say that this shows that I'm not where I used to be, I'm not as strong, but yes, it's a fresh day. I hear that. I think, and this is a guy who, you know, nose to nose, we protested against the Pope, and it's more dangerous to protest against the Pope than it is against the President of the United States, believe me, because he's a theological leader. And I was very critical of the Pope then, wrote articles, and I was going wild. Now, I Howard, you're my Rebbe. But having said that, because his, you know, when he died, right away, the media, right away, they have like they have it all in their Googles, whatever it is. So Rabbi, give me a comment, because they know they want a negative comment, you know, because I'm going to say something about.
What did you say?
I said that he was. They asked me now, so now I could say, I finally can get it out of my mouth that he did many great things. That's something I couldn't have said 20 years ago. I said he did many great things, but I pointed out that he was the one who embraced Kurt Waldheim and he called him the Prince of Peace. Waldheim was an unrepentant Nazi. This is the man who, he was the one who inspired the convent at Auschwitz, absolutely. He's the one who built it. He was the one who went to Mauthausen and didn't say the word Jew. Upset a lot of people. It's like the rabbi of Austria said, the only Jew he mentioned was Jesus, and he's not, you know, he didn't mention any other Jew. But I just want to, so I agree with you, but I want to, you know, the Pope is a theologian, and he's a theologian, and Pope Benedict, these are theologians who are very brilliant. They know their text, and I'm a theologian. And that's my language. I mean, when I go to sleep, this is what I dream about. I'm sorry, I dream about these texts. Everybody dreams about their own things. I dream about, you know, what am I going to say this morning? I know how it's going to be ready for me, and Estelle's going to cut me up and all that. But let me tell you what it is, Howard. Let me tell you what he was referring to. But we're going to spend a moment on this. Chapter 25, page 141.
Yeah.
I see your side, but I just want you to see my side.
I'm listening.
Okay. What happened was Rebecca gets pregnant. We're going back to Rebecca. And Isaac had married Rebecca. And then it says that the fetuses, or the foeti, the plural of fetuses, whatever, and the fetuses, they are struggling with each other. So she gets very, very concerned. And she goes Vayitrotzitzu there, you know, and she goes to an oracle. It's interesting, she doesn't go to her own husband, but she goes to this divine figure to find out what's going on. And this divine figure says, this oracle says, well, the reason they're struggling in your stomach is because they're going to always be struggling with each other. And then, if you take a look at sentence 23, Vayoma Adonai La, and the Lord says to her, to explain why there's a struggle in her belly, Shnei Goyim Bivitnech, look at the English there, two nations are in your womb. Ushnei le'umim me'ma'ayach yiparedu, and two people shall be separated from your bowels. Ula'om mil'om yematz, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people. Now look at the next three words, neighbor.
And the elder shall serve the other.
Rav yavod tsa'ir.
Right.
And the eldest, here it has reference to Isa, yavod tsa'ir shall serve the younger. I have no doubt in my mind. I have too much respect for Pope John Paul. This is a theologian par excellence. He knew the Bible. And I believe when he said that, he was saying things on many, many different levels. But having said that, it is a great thing that he went into the synagogue.
I you know something? I tell you something. I'm going to bring you a book.
Okay.
It's a thin book. It's written by an English psychiatrist who died in a very posh way. He died on the tennis courts in southern France about 15 years ago. Because it only means that if you know what you know.
Right.
You think he was talking to people of your theological level?
We have no argument. Because we're going to move on, but I hear what you're saying, and I'm fond of telling the story, which I probably told you, that for years, and this is not about me, but I'll share this, a me story. Over the years, I've debated Leonard Fine. Going back, if you remember back to 1982, he was at that time the editor of Moment magazine, a very big left winger, and I was a flaming right winger, and we debated. And sure enough, it's now 2006, and we're still debating. 2007, we're debating. And there was one debate where we really took off our gloves. I mean, you know, the last debate, he didn't show up. I said, it's okay, he doesn't have to show up. I'll be Leonard Fine, I'll tell you what he says. I just debated him. We had a chance they said, you have a chance now to ask each other a question. So I turned to Leonard, I said, Labela, we've been at this for 25 years. I want to ask you a question. Do you think today any differently than you thought 25 years ago? Is your thinking about this was about the Middle East any different? He thought for a moment, he said, it's absolutely the same. I'm more convinced that I'm right. And I said, you know, I said to the audience, Leonard has his position, I have my position, but that's the difference between the two of us. He is in the same spot. I'm not in the same spot. I may disagree with him, but I'm not where I was 25 years ago. I'm not where I was 5 years ago. So Howard, all I'm saying is that there are nuances, and I don't know what's in his head. It's not the Bible saying that the intention of who knows what was in his head. I view the Pope as a human being, and I wish exactly Jewish leaders right. would show respect to Jewish religious leadership on par that they show respect. Let me not get off and running on the Pope. You know, I've been around the bend on that one. So let's go back to the text. We're back to it. Yes, Ted.
I think Howard wanted to say something.
No,
Howard, I bet.
This is going to bring us back again.
And I wanted to comment there for him.
Maybe I stand to be corrected, but I have read that the Hebrew Scriptures, as we know, prophesizes a Messiah.
Is
that correct?
Yes, it does.
Now, these prophecies occurred before the beginnings of Christianity.
Yes.
Jesus was accepted as a Messiah.
That's correct.
The Hebrews at that time, and still we today, do not accept that.
That's correct.
And this, to me, has always been the thorn in the throat. I don't know if I'm right metaphors. The major issue in the Catholic Church that we, as the people who prophesy Messiah, will not accept the Messiah as they see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the subtle issue in back of even today, I can't
it's
put myself
not subtle.
In the Pope's mind, but I think that's the major issue going on. Yes, he can call us, he can say, he is a very man of brotherhood, but yet, He's tied down to
right.
that.
I think you've raised, we're off the text here, but I think you've raised, Howard, a major point, that in much of Christianity, not all of Christianity, there is a belief that if you believe that Jesus saved you, then you are redeemed. If you don't believe, you're in a lot of trouble. And therefore, the Jewish people who don't believe in Jesus as the Messiah, we are in trouble. So it is very, very, you know, from a Christian perspective, from that more fundamentalist perspective, it is very, very difficult for them to accept, to accept Judaism. That's why they're missionaries. They're missionaries in their own minds, because the only way we can be saved is if we believe in Jesus. And I must tell you that Judaism is much more embracing. The bottom line Jewish belief is that even if you are not Jewish, if you are of a different faith, a Christian who was born a Christian, even one who believes in the Trinity, which is not the perfect belief in the one God, Judaism for the Christian says that's wonderful. That's why we do not seek out converts. At the moment of conversion, I say to the person in the mikveh, God will love you just as much if you are not Jewish. Just as much. And certainly Islam, from a theological perspective, is even easier for Judaism to embrace, because Islam, unlike Christianity, is much more a monotheistic order. There's also a view about religion that is not tied to theology, but is rather tied to behavior. As long as someone, even if someone professes a different belief, as long as that person conducts himself or herself ethically in life, Judaism says that's fine. That's why a Christian can walk up to the Western Wall and pray and probably in his own heart pray to Jesus. Can you? You can. Sure, you can. Can we go up to the Temple Mount? I tried it. I went up there, I started to daven mincha. It took 3 seconds, and they stopped me. You can't daven mincha up there. Because it is a place for Islamic prayer, not Jewish prayer. In that sense, Judaism, which is very, very often connected to being more narrow, less embracing of others, as a matter of fact, Judaism is much more inclusive. It's an extremely universal faith community, and I stand by that. Judaism makes space for people of other faiths, mm-hmm. is not interested in people converting into Judaism, because Judaism fundamentally believes that all human beings are created in the image of God. There's fundamentally no difference. We were given a certain covenantal responsibility, but all human beings are created with neshamot, are created with souls. Now that is different than most of the other faith communities.
But not all Jews feel as you do.
That's correct. That is correct. And that's why there's an open orthodoxy, and that's on its fundamental level what we're all about. Yes, Ted.
I'm not arguing with Howard, nor with you, but I think that it might have made a difference to how you and Howard would have viewed what the Pope said, if he said, not that you are my elder brother, but you are my parent. Mm-hmm. If that right. would have given right. a little bit more covet right. and a little bit more appreciation of where
right.
we are in relationship to each other.
All I'm saying is that when a man of that stature and that knowledge speaks, he is reading from a written text, and he chooses his words. I know I choose my words very carefully, something I did not do in my earlier years in the rabbinate. I choose my words very, very carefully, as best as I can. He chooses his words more carefully. First of all, he has many, many more people who are vetting his text. I have no one. He has hundreds of people probably vetting his text.
Oh, yeah.
And there is meaning behind. Having said that, we're all Howard. I agree with you. He's flowers to the Pope.
It would make a more peaceful world if you didn't think that way.
Yeah.
You know, it would make the multi-millennium long yeah. family feud yeah. a little easier.
He was saying that, he was saying it at a time. You should just know, when he was embracing Kurt Waldheim, he called him a prince of peace. These things were very, very disturbing. And that's the context of the way it happened. Right. I'm back to my Reuven stuff. Yes.
Let's get past the Pope.
Yeah.
You said something regarding...
my Bubba used to say, how do you greet the Pope on the holidays. Howard, don't take this thing. This is my brother. Right, you see, Brian will remember.
What's a dias pious?
Gudjantif Pontiff.
What's a dias pious?
I said, go ahead, I'm sorry. Charles, go ahead. Get us on track. These guys get us off track.
Rebecca went to a soothsayer, a seer, as compared to going to her husband.
Yeah, I pointed out that.
But they referred to it as Adonai. And I thought Adonai was specifically reflected to.
That's a great point.
God.
She goes, what's the expression? Let's get it exact. She goes.
An oracle, right?
She goes to an oracle. The language in the Bible. The language in the Bible is Vatelach Lidrosh Et Hashem.
Yeah.
She goes to seek out the Lord. Bayom Hashem. Look, you can go to an oracle and who knows who this was. There's a lot of discussion in the Midrash. Was it Shem? Who was it? And this person spoke with the Spirit of God.
I don't know. He doesn't refer only to God.
Right. What you're saying is that maybe she went in sort of like in private solitude, and she was speaking
she
to
prayed.
God.
Okay. God,
I think that that's a wonderful interpretation. Another interpretation is she went to someone. When the prophet speaks in the name of God. It's like God is speaking. When Isaiah speaks, Jeremiah speaks, Ko Amar Hashem, Ko Amar Adonai. So it could go both ways, but it's a wonderful, wonderful interpretation. Yes?
I don't want to get us off track again, but I'm going to ask you a loaded question.
No.
You mentioned converts before.
Yes.
All right. A convert who truly loves Judaism, lives as a Jew, raises his children as a
right.
Jew, had a conservative conversion.
Right. Now we're off and running. But we go out of respect to, we have to hear Flora. Go ahead.
What's his real status?
Right. Back to the text.
Depends on whom you speak.
You know what, maybe another time we should have a discussion of conversion. It's a complicated topic, and it's especially complicated these days because I am not happy with the position of the chief rabbinate, where the chief rabbinate has taken the most stringent position about conversions, which I believe is not what the Rambam says. It's not what the Shulchan Aruch says.
Well, how do they get to their opinion?
Well, that's, you know, maybe we'll have a series of discussions on that.
Called ego.
And
absolutely. Power.
Where am I? I'm coming back to the story. We want to know why it is that Reuven is the one who's most concerned. So I want to share with you a thought. I actually heard this years back. I heard it directly from Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I have not seen this written anywhere. So this is really worth the price of admission. A lot has been written about him, but I heard him say this. He asked this question. He said, Jacob was a very powerful figure. How is it that the brothers were brazen enough to sell Jacob's favorite? How is it? How did they come to that? And he argues that it all came from a famous sentence, I should say famous, from a sentence in the story of in Brishit. If you take a look at chapter 35, sentence 22. Vayhi Bishkon Yisrael, page 213. Ba'aretzahi, and it came to pass when Israel dwelt in the land, Vayelech Reuven, and Reuven went, Vayishkav et Bilha Pilegesh Aviv. Now, when you read this sentence on its face value, what is it saying?
It's terrible. Gilai Arias.
It says that Reuven, the eldest, had relations, this is right after Rachel dies, with Bilhah, who was Rachel's concubine, handmaid. It says he lies with Bilhah, the concubine of his father.
He wanted to take over.
Ah, so there is an ancient history, there is the idea that the way you establish that you are the heir is the man, the son, has relations with his father's wife. Rachel not being around, because she had died, he literally lies with Bilhah. Vayishma Yisrael. This is like Shema Yisrael. Israel heard this. And this is one of the few sentences.
Israel being Jacob.
Yeah. Why is he called Israel?
Because it had, this has implication. That's a good question. When is he called Jacob? When is he called Israel? Mm-hmm. It says Vayishma Yisrael, and you see there's a big space, and then there's that pay. This is one of the few sentences in the Torah that doesn't end. This sentence doesn't end. He heard this. He listened. What did he say? He didn't say anything. He was so angry. He was so upset that it was beyond words. And when his son says, you know, I'm, you know, Jackie Gleason style or whatever it is, but Dad, I'm trying to establish my heirship. Jacob says, you're my son. This is the way of the world. This is not the way our family, this is not the way a Jewish family conducts itself. And Jacob, Israel is absolutely, absolutely silent. Interesting, in the next sentence 23, it says, Vayihiyu v'nei Yaakov shnei masa. And Jacob had 12 children. I always wondered about this sentence. We all know that Jacob had 12 children. We studied this last year. We got through the whole text of how the children were born. Everybody knows he has 12 children. And what I'd like to share with you is that in relations, in parental relationships with children, in spousal relationships, one of the tests of the relationship is our ability to open up and talk to each other. But sometimes, on rare occasions, silence is golden. Sometimes in relationships, as close as we may be with someone, we have to know when to be silent, when not to talk. So I'm just wondering, when Jacob really hears about it, he doesn't react. He hears it. He doesn't say anything to Reuven. And that's why the next sentence says he had 12 children. Because had he said something at that point, he was so angry, he would have disowned him. It would have been the end of the unit of the family. Now we know that Jacob was upset, because on his deathbed, when he's giving blessings, he says to Reuven, "Pachas kamayim al totaki alita mishkevei avicha." You, what did you do? What did you do? You, right? Kialita mishkevei avicha. How dare you? He scolds him at the last moment for having had relations with Bilhah. That's the text. I want to share with you what the Midrash says.
But isn't that the way a parent usually is? I mean, we're not going to say anything because we want to keep our children.
Well, I think,
sometimes.
You
want to say something.
You sit in my seat and you hear all kinds of things. And one of my great priorities in my rabbinate is to keep families together. Right. And I keep hearing stories of families and siblings who are just apart, and sometimes the reason is all kinds of different reasons. Here, what kept the family together, we're arguing, is Jacob knew how to be silent. But I want to share with you a midrash. This is Reb Shlomo Yosef, dear friend from the Atria. Welcome. The midrash says it can't be. It just can't be that Reuben slept with his father's wife. It can't be. The Midrash, the text says that's what happened, and that's, by the way, what happened. Ein mikro yotzei midei pshuto. But the Midrash says, nah, Reuven could not have done that.
And she was the mother of Dan and Naphtali.
Right. So the Midrash says that could not have happened. And the Midrash says, here's what really, really happened. Estelle, here's the Midrash. We're studying Midrash on Monday nights. The Midrash says, Jacob had four wives, but basically, he was camped out in whose tent?
Rachel.
Who was his
friend?
Rachel. Now Rachel dies. So what does Jacob do? He says, Rachel is dead. He's got to move somewhere else. And he takes up lodging in the tent of Rachel's handmaid, Bilhah. Because he figures Bilhah is closest to Rachel. He loves Rachel so much that Bilhah becomes his primary wife. Reuven. The eldest son of Leah hears about this, and he says, this is unacceptable. Why is it unacceptable, Florence?
His mother, Leah's his mother.
He should go
after
to
all,
Leah.
He should not be going to Bilhah. He should be going
to Leah.
So one day when Jacob was at work, the Midrash says, Charlie, you with me? This is an interesting story. Reuben creeps into the tent of now Bilhah, where Jacob had his bed, and he takes out his most intimate of clothes, and Jacob comes home, and guess what? The bed is not in Bilhah's tent. The bed is in Leah's tent. That's what really, really happened. If you look at page 213, sentence 22, lay with Bilhah. This midrash is so famous that people think it's in the text. Mm-hmm. People think that this is the way it happened. There are some midrashim that are so famous that we think this is it. But the truth is, it's a midrash. Anyway, here it is. Here's what he says. Lay with Bilhah. He did not actually do this, but removed her couch from his father's tent. So he said the other way around. Okay. And scripture stigmatized his action as heinous as though he had lain with her. For during Rachel's lifetime, Jacob's couch was always in her tent. On her death, in Rachel's tent, on her death, he removed it to Bilhah's, Rachel's handmaid. Reuben resented this, saying, if my mother Leah was subordinate to Rachel, must she also be subordinate to Rachel's handmaid? Thereupon he removed her couch and substituted Leah. So it's the same idea. He says, Dad, you're not going to be with Bilhah, you're going to be with Leah. Now,
he was with Leah long enough, eight now, children.
Well, okay. Okay, now, here's what...
But he's the son.
Now, here's what Rabbi Soloveitchik says, and I'm going to leave you with this. He had such powerful insight into the human condition. As brilliant as he was a very brilliant man, his greatest brilliance was his understanding of life. There are many brilliant scholars who know every line of every page, but they don't have wisdom of life. He really had wisdom of life. He says, when I do something, there are two pieces to the action. First of all, there is the action itself, and then there is the impact of the action. Follow me. There is the action and the impact of the action. For example, I walk into a store and, God forbid, I steal something. Two things have happened. Number one, I have stolen. Secondly, the very act of thievery has affected my personality. I walk out of that store a very different person. The Rav says that sometimes the actions of a human being, when the action is assessed relative to the act itself, may be insignificant. But the consequences of the act could be great. I find this constantly. I meet students who would say to me, you know, Rabbi Avi, I remember one thing you did to me. I remember one thing, you know, from class that you said or you did. Now, years back when I was younger, my chest kind of, oh, wow, I remember one thing that I did. Well, now when a student says that, my heart drops because I hope it was something good. Not that it was something negative. And it's so often the case that we do something and it's not meant, and yet the consequences of what we do could be so profound. I know I feel this in the rabbinate, because part of the rabbinate is, and I love people, so I try to connect with people. And sometimes people would say, you know, Rabbi, you didn't come over to me, or you didn't say hello the right way. I didn't mean anything by it. But sometimes, you know, I'm a big sports fan, as you know. One of the great ball players who played for the Boston Celtics was Bill Russell. Bill Russell became a very sharp advocate for his people, for African Americans, for black people. And I heard him once talk about what really pushed him to be that advocate. And it was some incident where some teacher used the N-word. Now, of course, that's a terrible, terrible wrong. But the way he described it was almost like in passing, although I can't imagine that it's in passing. All I'm saying is you never know what will be the word, what's going to be the moment, what will be the action. It could be the smallest action. And the action itself is not of tremendous relevance, but the impact of that action is great, said the great Rabbi Soloveitchik, he said, when you assess the action of Reuven, he didn't mean anything by this. Because what was his goal? He wanted to protect his mother. So, you know, if you put him on the defensive stand, he says, listen, I didn't mean anything by this. I respect my father. Rachel had died. I didn't do anything until Rachel died. Now he moves in with Bilha. What about Mom? I didn't mean this. I think if your honor would hear this, he would say, hey, he has something to say. Said the Rav, the act, as it is assessed, in terms of the act, may have been, from his perspective, inconsequential. But the consequence of the act was great. And let me just explain. The consequence of the act was that Jacob was almost, lahavdil, a godfather figure. Who would ever, none of the sons would deem it possible to conspire against their father. But once Reuven is taking his father's most intimate belongings, his bed, his night clothes, and lifting it and carrying it, it impacted on the brothers. The brothers saw that in that the opening to challenge their father. Reuven didn't mean it that way, but the consequence of his act was a message to his brothers that father can be challenged. And he tried to argue, Rabbi Soloveitchik did, that was the opening for the brothers to sell Joseph. Once they saw that Reuven could rebel against his father by doing what we've just described, then the brothers thought, you know something, we could also rebel by selling Joseph. Now, I just want to finish this. I want to show you how
selling
this midrash by throwing him into the pit, ultimately
trying, and then selling.
Okay, now, and that's why Reuven takes the position that he takes in the sale. He comes to the defense of Joseph because he knows that he was the one at fault. He knows that he was the one who opened up this possibility by challenging his father, by moving the bed. He knows that this sent this incorrect message to his brethren. Now, I want to just clinch this. In chapter 37, if you take a look at the text, and with this we really have to end. Let's take a look at the text and see what happens. We're now in sentence 24. Vayikachu vayashlichu oto abora, page 234. They throw him into the pit. There's no water in the pit. Vayishvu lecho lechem. And then in sentence 25, they look up and they see a caravan of Ishmaelites. And now sentence 26. Vayome Yehuda elachav. Now Judah jumps in and he says, Ma betz hakina roget ochinu. Why should we kill our brother? Let him die in the pit. Vachisinu et tambo. Lechuvenim kirenu leishmaelim. Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. V'yadenu al tivo. He's our brother. And sure enough, the Midianites come by, and they schlep Yosef out of the pit, and they sell him. Sentence 29. Vayashav Reuven el Habor. V'hine ein Yosef Babor. And Joseph returned to the pit. Reuven returned to the pit. And behold, Joseph was not in the pit.
Where was Reuven when he had to return?
So where was Reuven?
Where was
Reuven during the sale? Says the same Midrash. You ready for this? Where was Reuven? He went off to the side by himself to fast and to ask for forgiveness, to repent. Al Shebilbel Yitzue Aviv. He asked to repent for having confounded his father's bed. Do you follow what's happening here? Precisely at that point, he is recognizing that he really was, he could have been the instigator, he could have been the one at fault for the sale. Still, you've got the last word.
First of all, this is all rationalization. Mm-hmm. Secondly, why should he even think that he had done something wrong?
Because he did.
If he in his own mind was defending his mother. He wouldn't have thought so.
Right. Let me say two things. Let me just react to both, because what you're saying is right on. You're saying it's rationalization. And I'm not arguing that point, because the reality is one person's rationalization is another person's understanding. And another person's understanding is the other person's rationalization. The Torah, I believe, has to be understood on many, many different levels. And again, we said this last night, it's not that the Midrash, it's not that everything in the Midrash is true, but the teaching is a teaching that is impactful for life. A Midrash which offers and says, we can't accept that this is, that Reuven slept with his father's wife, but this is what happened. And a teaching that emerges from that Midrash, that one has to consider not only the act, but the consequence of the act, and how the consequences could have a ripple of effect and have inspired, even if that's not the way it happened, that is a teaching, I think it's a teaching that has great importance.
But you're assuming that Reuven was felt guilty, and he did not feel guilty.
But you don't know.
Why should you assume that Reuven feels guilty if he's defending his mother, if he's being the good son?
Right.
Okay.
I hear that. We're going to have to stop here. Anybody? Yes. Brian, do a last comment. Any other comment?
I want to say, if he was upset about his father having relations with Bilhah or moving in there, he was trying to right a wrong. But what he did, he compounded the wrong. He didn't right it at all.
Well, neither did
he. He was aware of what he was doing.
But he was sticking up for his mother. And
what you said about action and impact,
one last word, Chevra. When Reuven, according to the Midrash, when he's doing all of that stuff, or even the simple interpretation, what Reuven is really declaring is, I am the eldest. Either the literal interpretation, Estelle's position, that is, he has relations with his father's handmaid. That's the way he establishes that he's the inheritor. Or he's moving the bed from Bilhah's tent to Leah's tent to say, Leah's the primary wife. What is Reuven saying in either the literal interpretation or the Midrashic interpretation? What is he saying? He is saying, Ani Amloch, I am the next leader. I am the heir. In this text, what is he doing in saving Joseph? He seems to have come full circle. In saving Joseph, he's stepping back and he's saying, you know something, maybe it's not for me. He's saving Joseph. He certainly is, any way you look at it, his behavior is very, very different. It's not the behavior of one who is grasping the mantle of leadership. He's stepping back and in the end, he certainly is saving Joseph. And in saving Joseph, he knows Joseph is the eldest of Rachel, the same Reuven, who was the grabber of the mantle of leadership, he now is stepping back and saying, I'm going to make space for someone else who can potentially be that leader. It is a different Reuven. And sometimes in life, Reuven becomes a person. Sometimes in life, we conduct ourselves in a certain way, and then something hits us and we say, you know, we're going to try to do it differently. This is basics, basic fundamentals of life itself. We're going to stop here. Great.
If I'm reading the book, it's very thin. It's about 75 or 80 pages. When you're on an airplane,
I'd love to see it.
Would you read it?
I will.
It's one of the best books I ever read in my whole life.
I'd love to see it. Rav Adam's coming in to teach. So.
Rabbi, could Reuven have done both?
He could have done both. It could be. Very well done.
After he's finished, he took out. But I have no. I don't. I